This meeting is now being recorded.
Thanks so much for this invitation to talk. I've had a couple times before where I presented with Mixie, and it's always been a pleasure. I was asked to do this by two, mainly focusing around the PHQ-9, but I think there'll be time for questions about things that are related, because it brings up associated issues, of course, when you talk about that topic. Switching to the second slide, I have nothing to disclose, but when putting together one of these things, of course, you tend to borrow slides from colleagues and from my past presentations that had to do with MCSE or ICSE or AIMS. So I have lots of people that helped me previously to thank for putting some of these slides together. I want to take entire credit for what you have here. Next slide. This is just because of our wonderful temperature in Minnesota lately. We say, Minnesota, you come for the culture, but you stay because your car won't start. And that's how we get our population to go up in Rochester, but it may not be the ideal thing to do. Switching to the next slide, why depression care is important. Just to set up, these are the PHQ-9 reminders that there's a high prevalence of depression in primary care, maybe 10 to 13%. If you look at the overall population, prevalence rates of depression are 2 to 3% in men and 4.5 to 9.3% in women. But if you look at those patients we're seeing in our primary care settings for Compass, for Diamond, there's a higher percentage. And there's a higher lifetime risk for women than men. You can see those statistics. It's the fourth most disabling condition, and it's going to be higher in that regard in 2020. And primary care provides at least 50 to 90% of the care for depressed outpatients. As we all know, the access to patients for patients to get into primary psychiatric care is pretty awful. And so often the care goes to primary care, even without the access problems, partly because of the stigma or the insurance issues. There's lots of reasons why that happens. Next slide. On the burden of depression, depressed adults have about twice the health care cost as non-depressed. That's why we're doing this Compass project. We're trying to increase the ability to manage those patients that are using high cost. And it's an undertreated condition. You can see only about half the 12 million cases are receiving treatment, and about a quarter of those are about a quarter of those are adequately treated. Next slide. And some of the challenges in primary care. As we all know, in primary care, there's limited time, there's competing priorities, there's limited follow-up. A lot of patients will drop out of treatment. And, you know, in some ways, this problem in primary care is not unique to primary care. In psychiatric settings, particularly when you go to psychiatric specialty places where they're trying to care for a large volume of patients, same kinds of things happen, where it's easier to start people on a treatment than it is to make sure that treatment actually gained ground. And so all these settings where there's a lot of patients in a small time frame, it's really important to think about another way to manage. And as I said before, there's limited access to mental health services. Next slide. And so we need to think about common metrics that are useful for improved communication in for us working together between mental health and primary care. And the metrics need to help us communicate between the patient and the clinician, between the primary care provider and the mental health specialty, and it helps us to aggregate data for quality improvement. So, next slide. So, what we often talk about when we're talking about the PHQ-9 in different settings, at least I've found useful, is to think about the PHQ-9 as a vital sign for depression. The vital signs that we use, or the things we use to monitor other illnesses, might be blood pressure for hypertension, hemoglobin A1C for diabetes, peak flow for asthma, LDLs for hyperlipidemia. And so that's what we, when we talk to primary care sites about PHQ-9, using the PHQ-9 as a vital sign. So we'll say to clinics where they're saying, we're not really comfortable with using the PHQ-9, we'll say, well, what about hypertension? Do you really see someone with hypertension without measuring their blood pressure, that kind of thing, to try to point out that it gets easy to see somebody with a chronic illness and go with not measuring, but are you really sure that the person's improving? And it tends to help us establish the patient's having those symptoms. It doesn't tell us for sure that they have the diagnosis, but it tells us that they have the symptoms. Next slide. So the advantages of the PHQ-9, it's a self-report instrument that can be used in person, so a patient can fill it out in the waiting room, which is probably one of the more common ways we use it here. It can be by the telephone, it can be online, it can be interactive voice response. So there's multiple ways you can administer it. And at the bottom, put in a couple of articles about using the PHQ-9 and validating it in alternative means of delivery through touchscreen computer, for example, or through telephone, use of the telephone. So it's nice that people have found that this is so important and pragmatic that they've realized that they need more than one way to deliver the care. It's also in a lot of different languages. PHQ-9 is available through a website that I attached here that Pfizer put together when it was more involved in the PHQ-9. You can go on that website and find copies of the PHQ-9 that have been used in other places and validated. It's always a little challenging with languages because, for example, a Spanish language group, it's not clear that every Spanish language group is exactly the same as every other. But I think it gives us a chance to make sure that when we see a patient who doesn't speak English, we try using an alternative form of the PHQ-9. And it's been tried in multiple patient populations. The PHQ-9 has been used in elderly, those with medical problems, et cetera. There's over 700 articles right now. If you go to the screeners website, you'll see there's a link that the author put together, Conkey put together, on all the people that have published articles on the PHQ-9. I think he has it only updated to a certain point, so I'm sure there's even more than that. So it's a very well-studied instrument. Next slide. So I was going to switch now to just talking about the concept of screening. And before I do that, should I stop to see if there are any questions? Okay. So next slide. When we talk about screening for depression, when I first started working on this, the U.S. Preventative Task Force was saying we think everybody should be screened for depression. They learned quickly that that doesn't work very well because most places don't have an off-ramp when you find somebody with that problem. So now the recommendation, as of 2009 anyway, are that you have to have some kind of staff-assisted depression care support if you're going to screen for adults for depression so that there's actually some way to manage that. Otherwise, what happens is the patients and the providers just get frustrated and the screening stops. So the questions that arise when you're trying to figure this out is, should we screen everyone if we do have a care support like Compass or Diamond in place? Or if we don't, who should we screen? Next slide. So one thing that has brought up is that if you're going to look at subpopulations, there are certain red flags where depression is comorbid. So some people will say, well, we'll look at those that have a history of depression because we know it tends to reoccur frequently, 50% after one episode perhaps, or 70 to 80% after more than one episode. Or if there's multiple unexplained somatic symptoms, that might be depression. Or if there's a recent major stress or loss, a person's a high healthcare utilizer, chronic pain and depression, we all know, go together. Chronic illnesses, diabetes, obviously, encompass, goes together with depression. If patients have some of these symptoms of depression, whether coming in with sleep or energy issues or weight loss. Postpartum women, highest risk for women is their postpartum, or if there's an issue of domestic violence. Now, I think that knowing about these red flags is great. I also have found, though, that trying to operationalize that and figure out how to have a trigger, in electronic trigger or a desk trigger, to know these people in a way that it automates it, it's a little trickier. But those are the groups that you expect to see a little more depression in. Next slide. So some places will screen for in the larger population with the PHQ-2. And I think people are probably familiar with it, but it's really the first two questions of the PHQ-9 on feeling down, depressed, or hopeless, and the one on anhedonia, or loss of interest or pleasure in doing things. And just like on the PHQ-9, there's a score of 0 to 3 based on how often a person has those symptoms. And the sensitivity and specificity of the PHQ-2 when studied by Kroenke, he's a primary care provider that was instrumental in putting together PHQ-9, the PHQ-2, and G87 and other tests, is 83% sensitive and 92% specific. So it's not a bad way to screen. What we found, though, in Mayo is that doing the PHQ-2, the questions that come up are, how do you monitor improvement? So you probably end up doing a PHQ-9 to get a broader score so you can really see what's happening and really clarify the diagnosis. And how do you record it in the chart? If you're going to record it, and if you go ahead and get the PHQ-9, you record the PHQ-2 results and then add 7 questions. And it's so fast to do a PHQ-9 that we have not actually, I don't think we've fully figured out a good way to use the PHQ-2. It's not a bad instrument. I'm just saying here that's what we've run into, and maybe others on the call have found a better way or a good way to implement it. We did try it once that worked pretty well, and I'll talk about how, a way that you can do that on the next slide. So on the slide that's titled Alternative Examples of the PHQ-9 Implementation, in one column I mentioned one option, is you can screen everyone. And here's where we tried this once where we had a PHQ-2, really a verbal PHQ-2, and we trained the roomers to ask those two questions as they were taking the person from the waiting room to their room in the clinic. And if the patient said yes to either question, or if the roomer just had a sense that they were minimizing in some way, maybe by the kind of things they were talking about or their concern, they could hand them a PHQ-9. But then if you do it this way, you need a plan as to what to do with the positives. So in that case, what would happen is the provider would enter the room and PHQ-9 would be completed. But what often happened is the PHQ-9 then never got entered into the electronic record very well. Sometimes they'd be dropped in a box or placed somewhere to be entered, and sometimes they wouldn't. So how do you put those results into the computer was one of our challenges. And then what's your plan when you find a positive? Is the provider now finding that their 7-minute appointment is going to be a 40-minute appointment, or do they have a way to get some help with a care coordinator or someone once they identify one? There is a little danger when you screen everyone of perhaps over-treating. And a psychologist that's written in this area spoke at one of our recent meetings, and he has great concerns that antidepressants might be prescribed for someone with a higher PHQ-9, simply because it's much harder to get that person evaluated by mental health for whether what's really going on or in therapy. It's much easier just to start an antidepressant. So his feeling is that if you screen everyone, even those that might be there for totally different reasons, you might over-medicate patients. There's also the challenge of burning out your patients. So some patients might be in 3 times or 5 times in a week if they're in some kind of course of treatment, where they have to come in for maybe some immunizations or some kind of treatment of a wound or something. And then they keep getting this form because it's hard to tell the system not to give it if it's given to everyone. And then you still need a system to follow patients. So once you identify people, do you give them everybody PCPN every time, or how do you get them if they don't come back, if it's dependent on them being in the visit? So I've learned from doing this over the years that there's no system that doesn't have a problem. It's a matter of finding the system that is right for your clinic with your resources. Another way to go is, and this is kind of what we decided to do when we started the Diamond Project, is we decided to kind of focus more on the providers identifying depressed people. But now there was an incentive to get a PHQ-9, because if they had a PHQ-9, these patients could actually get a care coordinator. Whereas without a PHQ-9, we wouldn't accept them into Diamond. And so that changed the dynamic from, if I find a depressed person, I got all my patients in the waiting room suddenly angry with me, to I can get my patient cared for because I can hand them off to someone who will gather the data that's needed and get me a recommendation before my next visit. And so that really worked pretty well to get patients getting more PHQ-9s, but certainly we're missing people who the provider either doesn't think about it or the patients are coming in a way that's obvious. We also try to make it easy to have the PHQ-9 available when you need it. So we try to have a paper version. We have the electronic PHQ-9 on the right in the medical record, where a provider can just click on the numbers in response to asking the patient on the phone or in person the answers. We have a scannable version, so that takes less time to enter a paper. We also have it on the patient portal, so a patient can fill out the PHQ-9 from home, and it goes right into their electronic record. That's only been done in a limited way so far, and has its ups and downs too, which I'd be happy to share if anyone's interested. And then finally, it's important after that to create a system to follow the PHQ-9, and that's what we did, is that anytime anyone has a score of 10 or more, we put a lot more electronic kind of systems in place that flag when somebody has previously had a score like that, so that if they come in and they haven't had a PHQ-9 in a given time frame, we make sure to get another one. We've also added a few things, like if they're on antidepressants and so on. And we are adding screening for vulnerable patients. Those postpartum women is an example that we're looking at. We have other vulnerable groups that we haven't figured out a plan for, but that's the right column is the column that it's working in Mayo Rochester fairly well. But Mayo is a big place, and so there are multiple varieties of how they use the PHQ-9 across all our clinics in several states. So we don't yet have a single model that we have worked out. There's a lot of information on this slide. I'm curious if anyone has any questions. Okay, next slide. So the PHQ-9, as you've seen it before, it's basically a systematic tracking of symptoms. It has the, I like to, when I talk about it to people, I like to tell them, you know, this is basically the DSM criteria for depression on a piece of paper. And I don't know how many people read the DSM. It's really not something you want to do for fun, right? So it's hard to remember when you're a busy practitioner to go up and say, you know, they look depressed, but do they meet the criteria according to what's written in that text? Well, it's right here. All 9 items are there, and it's supposed to be over a certain time frame. The time frame is already in the top. It has to have effect functioning. Functioning is in that question 10. So it's quick, easy to administer, and it has DSM criteria in it, which it's interesting. Some of my colleagues would say, you don't want to use the PHQ-9 because we don't really think that's what depression is. We think what's on the Beck Depression Inventory is what depression is. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting comment coming from a psychiatrist. It's saying that the thing that's written in the DSM is inaccurate, which I totally have some willingness to discuss. But if that's true, then shouldn't we be trying to get that corrected rather than using another way of identifying depression? But it's an interesting debate that I'm happy to talk about too if we need to. Going on to the next slide. if you break down the PHQ-9 like I was talking about, PHQ-9 looks for the five of nine symptoms, and it has to be present more than half the days in the past 2 weeks. And one of the symptoms has to be depressed mood or anhedonia. That's those first two questions. So it's like I said, the DSM criteria. The other thing is item 9 is something we always try to pay attention to because of suicidality. And it's interesting that there was a recent paper by Greg Simon, who's works out at University of Washington in group health. And he found that if the PHQ-9 item 9 was higher than 0, what you saw was an increased vulnerability to suicide. So it might not mean that the patient's going to kill themselves today, but instead what it might mean that they are, in a sense, more likely to kill themselves over a period of time, or attempt to kill themselves over a period of time. So that's I think, somewhat of an interesting difference and something to think about when we're trying to figure out how to handle item 9. Because we all know there's patients that say that they have suicidal thoughts and they've had them for a while. But I think it's interesting to think of it as a vulnerability and then thinking about how to lower that risk over time and rather than thinking they have to be hospitalized or something right away. Next slide. Dr. Kasselnik was involved in a study. Actually, I was one of the people being studied in the clinic at the time, where with the American Association of Family Practice, the American Psychiatric Association, and the College of Physicians, what they did is they tried to get psychiatrists who, at that time, weren't using the PHQ-9 to start using it. So this was actually done back in around 2000-2001, or actually no, a little later than that, between 2001 and 2008, so I think it's the mid-2000s. And they asked two questions of these psychiatrists who were implementing it. Did they find the PHQ-9 scores valuable in their practice, and what percent of the treatment decisions were altered based on the score? It was published by an author named Duffy in Psychiatric Services. They found that about 93% of the time the PHQ-9 was helpful in treatment decisions. Next slide. And how did the PHQ-9 influence treatment? It might have changed treatment about 40% of the time, and they confirmed treatment about 60% of the time. And this was a bit astonishing to the, interestingly enough, to the mental health group, who kind of can get, you know, a specialist can get a little sort of focused on how they feel that measurements aren't that important, that they have this internal sense. But knowing from my own perspective, sometimes I would think I knew this person pretty well, but when I asked them to fill out a piece of paper, they would volunteer that they were feeling worse. But because maybe they liked me or we had a relationship, they would minimize it verbally. And I would, that paper version let me kind of ask why that disconnect, and it helped me to understand them better. So that's just another way to describe how the psychiatrists have found it useful when talking to groups that are uncertain about using a tool like this. Next slide. So now switching over to diagnosis, next slide, PHQ-9 and major depression. Well, as we said, this is sort of a similar thing, looking for 5 out of 9 symptoms. One of them has to be anhedonia, and one has to, and paying attention to item 9. Next slide. And the score on the PHQ-9, it goes from 0 to 27, and you can see kind of where the score falls. Remember, in COMPASS, we talk about 10 or more to get depression. And so it's really a 10 moving away from things that are thought to be no depression or minimal. And when you look at the population of people who get the PHQ-9 scoring below 10, they tend to find that if you don't do anything with those people, or if you do something, you can't really tell the difference, because most of those people, their mood improves over time. So it's often a life stressor that's involved, not necessarily something needing an intervention. And that's one of the reasons why they thought that it would be good to have a cutoff of 10. Next slide. Another reason that the 10 was chosen is because of where sensitivity and specificity kind of intersect. And if you screen patients they've done studies where they've looked at scores of the PHQ-9 at different levels and, say, compare it with a gold standard like a psychiatric interview or a structured interview. And then they see what levels is it sensitive and specific. And just to remind us all, sensitivity is telling you how well does this test pick up or miss people who have depression. And you catch, is your net catching everyone who is really depressed? Or are you missing, if it's a low sensitivity, you're missing a lot of people who have depression. Now, of course, your net could pick up a lot of people who don't have depression, and your sensitivity will still be high because, if you're running a net through and you're catching all of the turtles in your net, but you're also catching a lot of other fish, you could be sensitive for turtles, but not specific. And that's what specificity is. How well does it distinguish between true depression and something similar? So what you want is that you want to test it so sensitive, finding the people you're looking for, but also not catching a lot of other things that look like it. And the sensitivity and specificity is about 88% in the original article by Kroenke. I've attached it there for a PHQ-9 score of 10. Now, interestingly, if you look at a meta-analysis that was just published last year, 2012, a couple years now, I guess, they came up looking at all the different articles that have been published on this issue. They came up with a range between 8 and 11 on the PHQ-9 as a good cutoff scores. And so you'll see some variation on what score is, both sensitivity and specificity. One of those challenges is the setting in which you do a test like this. Next slide. So if you look at this, is from that meta-analysis. Here they're taking 6 studies in this table that's a little complicated. You're looking at a white table too. It's right out of the paper. And it says in primary care settings, 6 studies were done, about 1,900 patients. Sensitivity is given, specificity, and you go all the way across to diagnostic odds ratio, which really is, and I gave the definition there, the ratio of the odds of being positive if you have the disease, the odds of being positive if you do not have the disease. So if that's higher, it's much more likely that you're getting, it's really that's what you're looking at. And you can see the hospital setting, which is the second row, has a lower diagnostic odds, which is sort of interesting. It makes you realize that if you use the same test in different settings, it might have different sensitivity and specificity. As you can see, it has a different sensitivity in the hospital than it does in the primary care and the ones that they've used. Some of this can happen because prevalence, how many people in a given group are depressed, can affect sensitivity and specificity. But the same values of sensitivity and specificity don't always translate to each setting. So that's what makes it a little tricky to choose a cutoff, but the choice of 10 was given because it helps cover the primary care setting pretty well. Next slide. So the diagnoses that we're looking for depression are the codes of the 296.2, the 296.3, and the 300.4. So we have the major depression, single episode is the 2, the recurrent, the 3, and dysthymia. And dysthymia, the PHQ-9 is not necessarily focusing on dysthymia. If it were, instead of saying in the last 2 weeks, it might have another question about in the last 2 years. How have you ever had times where you feel this mood state was gone for a period of time? And that's what happens with dysthymia, is that it just doesn't clear up very well. Next slide. So going to treatment, and then we'll have time for some questions. Treatment goals, next slide. We're looking, remember, when we're treating people with depression for PHQ-9 of under 5, no depression. Now, in COMPASS, we often are trying to aim at just getting it under 10 because these patients are often treatment-resistant and harder to get stabilized. But overall, when you're treating someone specifically for depression, you want to try to get it under 5. You're often also trying to get that person to some level of functioning. So there are times when you can't really get the depression entirely gone, but you can get their functioning back, and that's an improvement. And we talk about that here in our staffing of which patient it might be just to focus on their functioning as a reasonable target, like you might do with a chronic pain patient where you can't really remove their pain, but you can get them back to functioning. Also, looking at patient satisfaction is another goal that we often do when we're doing treatment. Next slide. So here's that same slide that showed those different levels of symptoms, and then it's attaching to what you could do in those situations. And you can see that when it's 0 to 4, it's not clear to me that's depression, if you think that's accurate. Or if it's depression, it's under the right treatment already with the right medication, so it's like measuring a blood pressure and seeing a normal level on somebody on the right dose of lisinopril or something. If it's 5 to 9, then it might be depression, but waiting for a little while is probably the right initial management. That means not just sort of saying we won't ever talk about this again because we're busy, but checking back with that person and seeing if their CHQ-9 is going to bump up above 10 again, or if it's really on its way down, or what's really happening. Now, there are exceptions. Sometimes patients of 5 to 9 are minimizers, you know, a good Norwegian saying, I'm not really that depressed. And we can talk more about that, and I was talking to Sue about this, but, you know, one of the ways we handle this is if I get a PHQ-9 of a 6 or 8 on somebody, I really don't think that's accurate. What I try to do is I sit down and go through the items with the patient to make sure we are on the same page, because they may have been telling me verbally in the conversation that, you know, I really don't feel well, but in writing they're saying, oh, no, it's about a 6. So I'll just try to talk them through, and if there's a clear difference, I'll try to clarify why that is, and which is just the verbal comment correct, or is the written one correct. It also helps me to understand in the future when working with them what is going to be the way that they display distress. So I wouldn't just bump up their PHQ-9 to a higher score in order to get them into Compass or Diamond, but instead what I would try to say is, let's make sure the PHQ-9 is accurate, because it's like getting a blood pressure measure on someone and you have a high score of systolic of 140 and you think, well, let's put them on lisinopril. Well, you wouldn't do that typically. You try to figure out if this is a single reading or if this is because they're scared to come in the hospital or it's white coat syndrome, et cetera. It's kind of thing with PHQ-9. You kind of want to check to see if the finding makes sense. Just look under the hood a little bit and try to understand it. As you can see on the PHQ-9 of 10, here they're still thinking of watchful waiting might be a possibility, but you could start antidepressants or you could start psychotherapy because they work about equally well at that level. And then you go up further, and it's also equally well as you get into the higher and the moderate, but once you get into severe, many people find psychotherapy is hard to do there when they can't think clearly enough to do it. Now, this is somewhat of an exception in patients with borderline personality, I find, where they have had a PHQ-9 in the 20s for a long time. And they're used to having it at that level. And they're a little bit like the chronic pain patients, where more medication may not make a big difference in their pain. It's a matter of learning how to live with those feelings. Take that last one with a grain of salt. Any questions about that? We'll have time for questions at the end. Okay, next slide. So quickly on two or three slides on treatment, and then we'll wrap up. So evidence-based treatment, for when you find a depressed patient, you're looking for antidepressants, looking for a response in maybe 4 to 8 weeks if you're giving enough dosing. If you're giving cognitive behavioral therapy, and we've had a little struggle here getting people in communities to cognitive behavioral therapy that we thought was really adhering to that idea, and getting a person to go regularly when they're busy. But if you can work out those kinds of logistical issues, 8 to 12 sessions of cognitive behavioral therapy is thought to be enough to bring someone significantly better. So some of the primary care providers we might tell them, if you're going to tell someone they don't want medicines, they want to go to CBT, tell them, well, you're talking about a 2 to 3 month time frame if you see somebody once a week before, you know, we should really see a difference if you go. You have to go and have to actively participate. Whereas with the medicine, you might be talking about 1 to 2 months if the medicine works, it might not work. And so it gives us time to make sure you check in on somebody. Other kinds of evidence-based therapy include personal therapy, include mindfulness training, and we can go into different kinds of therapy if you're interested. Behavioral activation, of course, we want our care coordinators to do as much behavioral activation as the patient can learn from, and it's really powerful in terms of affecting depression and medical illness. And so it's important to think of that as a treatment, not just something that you do. Slide. So this is the cartoon that David Kastelnik loaned me. These two dinosaurs are eating people. It says, of course you feel great. These things are loaded with antidepressants. Slide. So why use an antidepressant? Maybe effective in 70% of the patients with major depression eventually. We talked about 4, sometimes 12 weeks, depending on how much that titration of medicine took. It also reduces relapse if they stay on antidepressants, but also CBT can reduce relapses. And it's important to remember that depression is a chronic illness. It returns 50% of the time after one episode and goes up after more episodes. So we try to talk to patients and say, how many episodes have you had now, and whether they're going to want to go off that medication once they're in remission or stay on it longer term. Depends on whether they've either decided they'll just stay on the medicine and it seems to work for them without side effects, or whether they're willing to do a course of psychotherapy and, in a sense, change their way of handling this chronic illness. Maybe that's like, if you take someone off their insulin, or do you wait till they actually learn to manage their diet and exercise in a way that they can keep their weight steady and their blood sugars in pretty good control and then taper their insulin? It's that kind of concept. Slide. That is probably the last slide, I think, on treatment. People may have seen this little crossing orange and yellow graph, but the orange one is side effects, the yellow is therapeutic effects, and it's kind of an unfortunate thing. We talk about, to our patients about how antidepressants will get you side effects right away, exactly what you want when you're depressed, right? And then therapeutic effects a little bit later. And it's a matter of trying to make sure that patients recognize that the benefit's coming. So we the messages we were trying to give the patients, take the medications daily, wait a little while. The side effects tend to wear off, as you can see from the side effects curve there. And keep taking the medication even if you're better. It's not like an aspirin. When your headache's gone, you don't need aspirin. And check with the MD. It's not addicting. Those are the kinds of messages that we try to give to our patients who are uncertain about this use of antidepressants. So last slide is a video example. I heard there was some questions about administering the PHQ-9, and people may have more specifically what kind of questions there are. But if you go to this website at the Ames Center, you can actually see a video of a person giving a somewhat irritable patient a PHQ-9, and how it goes and how she stays with it as the patient pushes back a bit. And then on a follow-up with the patient, she gives another PHQ-9 when the patient is coming for a second visit. So if that's helpful, I just wanted to mention that website. So this is where I'd be ready for questions if there are any.
Dr. Williams, this is Sue, and maybe while others are putting their thoughts together on questions, one question I often hear from the organizations that have started monitoring and measuring for depression is some concern about, well, if I do this, it somewhat opens Pandora's box. What are your thoughts on that?
Is that again, if I do what? It opens the box?
When, if I measure for depression, I'm going to open this whole Pandora's box and just open the floodgates of things that I might not be so comfortable dealing with.
Yeah, I think that's a common sentiment. It's a little also like asking about suicide. People have the same feeling. In psychiatry clinics, it might be asking about their lipids. Or even though we know the lipids are high because of some of our medications. And I think it partly reflects the need to think about a plan of a care in a location when you find a patient, and then practicing asking these questions with someone who's done it a little more is often helpful, so you can walk through the way to word things and how to handle questions that come up. But if you don't have any backup, there's no mental health resources at all, and there's no one in the group that wants to handle the mental health problems, it's a little hard to blame people with that kind of feeling. But with backup of a psychiatrist reviewing with care coordinators and that kind of thing, there ought to be a way to handle that concern.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
So I know we have groups of care managers, and I'm hearing that care managers still have some, you know, questions about managing depression. I mean, we have Dr. Williams, our expert here, so if there's questions out there, I really encourage you to take the opportunity of his expertise.
People in Michigan are shy.
Yeah, we're real shy. How about, you know, sometimes we hear about patients taking some herbals and some concerns about having, you know, side effects of that. Any thoughts on that, Dr. Williams?
Sure, yeah. You know, herbal medications, I tend to take a fairly practical approach to that. Often when I run into somebody who are taking herbal medicines for depression, what I first want to understand is what they know about those medicines. I'll do a little education and make sure that the reasons they're taking them, they understand the limitations. I tell them that herbal medications, if they're thinking they are natural and therefore better, I want to try to define what they mean by natural, because, of course, there's lots of poisons in nature that are natural. And then I want to talk about that they're not FDA regulated. So you have to be certain that if you get a bottle of something that you know that's what it is. And then we talk about where the evidence is of herbal treatments that actually have some antidepressant effect, like with St. John's Wort, for example, and that they might have drug interactions with some of the things you're taking. So you have to be cautious when you're going on and off of them. But that if a person really wants to use an herbal remedy, as long as they understand some of these limitations and they're willing to put up with side effects with the herbal remedies, what then I do is say, okay, then how will you know it works? Because I found it's interesting that patients will have double standards. They take a prescribed medicine, they'll say, well, you know, I expect this, this, and that. But they've been taking herbal remedy for 6 months with no evidence of any benefit. And I'll ask, why is that? And can we come up with how we would know that a herbal remedy is helping? And if it is helping, great. If it's not helping, then let's figure another option out.
Thank you. Others, questions out there? How about on the PHQ itself? We've got a question through the computer, Dr. Williams. It says, do you have any suggestions for training care teams, MAs, to administer the test and any training scripting? So beyond in our region, Dr. Williams, we have primarily RN care managers, but we also have care teams that are conducting PHQ-2 and sometimes PHQ-9. So what are your thoughts on training MAs and others in the practice team that might not have a licensure?
I have done a little training like that, but I certainly don't feel that I've done as much as where I can just hand you out something that would I know would work. Entira, I don't know if you've heard of Entira, but that's a group in Minnesota that used non-nurses for care coordinators, and so they've done a training like that. And we're looking in Mayo with our multiple sites to look it down this direction. If I were trying to design it, I probably put together a little less detailed slide presentation like this about PHQ-9s. Then I do a lot of role playing with people that are familiar with the PHQ-9 and just have people practice one giving the PHQ-9 to the other and vice versa, and then have people come up with concerning comments and then coach people on how they practice it. So with a group of MA level people and maybe a few RNs that have done this and maybe someone in mental health, you could probably have volunteers come up and then practice going back and forth. And then have a backup person you can call when you're doing the PHQ-9 if you have questions about what didn't go well. But like I said, I haven't put those trainings together that much myself. Hope that helps the question.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And maybe related to that is setting the PHQ testing up. And you and I spoke a little bit about that. And in our primary care practices, they're fast-paced. Sometimes the patient can sense that we're in a hurry. So what are your thoughts in setting up the room or the area in conducting the PHQ and how we can set that up so patients feel they can answer the questions, not how they think we want them to answer them?
Yeah, I'd be interested in hearing a little about some examples of where it didn't go very well. Where we run into troubles here are, for example, if it's a, we use the PHQ-9M, it's a modified version for adolescents, and surprise, surprise, the parents and the adolescents don't always fill it out the same way when talking about the adolescent. So the way the desk resolved that would be to have a bunch of paperwork that they have to give out to the patient and some other paperwork for the parents, and they just include a PHQ-9 in each one and keep them both really busy, and so they don't look over their shoulder so much at the other person and get the answers. And then privately, we'd follow up with the adolescents in another room. We've had challenges with non-English-speaking patients and in a busy place where someone hasn't taken the time to go find a non-English PHQ-9, and then working with the interpreter, and it's already filled out as I enter the room, but I'm not certain how it was interpreted and to what extent I can rely on it. So I have to go through and ask some of the questions again. Having people be able to fill it out in paper and hand it to the desk can work because it feels a little private in some patients. But some patients worry, well, the desk, I may know them and they'll look at my scores. And then how to put them into the electronic system. Being sensitive to that, telling them they can just bring it to the room if they want rather than hand it in. That's one of the things we've done. Being able to fill it out online or electronically or through a voice-activated thing, sometimes that's useful to know that patients have that option and they can fill it out without anybody right there. Also, of course, because there's no one right there, it brings up the question of how does the message get received if it has an alarming kind of item 9. Who's paying attention to that? So each option has its pluses and minuses.
Thank you. That's very helpful. We have another question. What is mindfulness training? Could you provide some information about that?
So mindfulness is an approach to distress tolerance, I guess. It's used in situations with pain, it's used in anxiety, it's used with depression. One might think of it, I sort of think of it being a little Eastern in its approach. And I guess a one way to think of it is they encourage a person in mindfulness to stop being in the future or the past. So when I'm depressed, I'm usually in the future or the past and not in the present. So I'm thinking, it's not going to work out with my new job. They won't like me. I'm going to fail, and then what will I do? Or I'm thinking, I really miss the way it was. It used to be so much better. Or, so-and-so passed away, and I miss them. And it's very hard to be just where I am at the moment. And mindfulness, one of the strengths of it, I think, is to help people learn, pay attention to how often they're spinning their wheels, not being present where they are. The other thing I think it's powerful in mindfulness is it teaches a person not to be judgmental about what's happening. So I have pain in my leg. Okay, I have pain in my leg. Therefore, I'm sure what this means is I'm going to have a surgery on my leg. It's just registering without judgment. It allows a person to not lie about what's happening, but not also add all these layers that we add when we see something. And it can focus on a meditative kind of way of approaching things, which, as we know, meditation is very relaxing and calming and reduces the sense of stress. So those are some quick comments about mindfulness. Obviously, a much more complicated subject. And I think there's a book on mindfulness and depression that's out there. It's written by a guy with the same name as me, but don't give me any credit. It's certainly not me that wrote that book. But we've given that book out to people and has a CD in it that teaches some of the mindfulness. And it's shown in evidence base to help with people, especially with chronic depression, where they constantly have a high depressive score. It's like you might think of it helping in chronic pain. Good question?
Thanks. Yeah, that's great. Any other questions from folks on the line? We've got one more minute, so here's your opportunity to take advantage of Dr. Williams and his vast experience. I'm not seeing any other questions come up on the computer, Dr. Williams, and we're getting close to end, so I thank you very much for presenting today and giving us great information. It's been very helpful for those that are on the line. We'll make sure and let you know how to get to the webinar information for those that weren't able to join from your clinics. And we'll do somewhat of a summary, and we will also be sending out a questionnaire to identify how else we might be able to help and support you. So I encourage you to answer the questionnaire. And with that, thanks so much, Dr. Williams. Appreciate it. And we'll be back on the line at 4:30, another half an hour.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks much. Thanks, everyone, for joining.